Welcome to Acetate Modulation, episode 016, an audiophile hangout. Acetate Modulation is your podcast that covers all the wild and wonderful world of modular, exciting and unusual instruments, guest interviews, sound snippets, and we also take a look into interesting sound and visual art projects too. I'm Ed Ball.
And I'm Ben Wilson.
Hi Ben, what have you been up to?
By this point, 31 days of videos and probably passing out on the 1st of February, either from withdrawal of not making a video that day, which I'm definitely not going to turn a camera on the 1st of February. But yeah, doing the thing a day, as Marcus called it, the kind of sound diary that Taylor Dupree did every day, and our friend Nigel Mullaney with his 31-day album from last year that's just come out this February, really inspired to do it. And I'm glad to say I will have hit all 31 days and some good content from it and some good habits, I think. It was a good habit-forming project for kind of trying to work fast and efficient. I wasn't learning modules in depth like the demos, so I can't necessarily churn them out any faster, but yeah, some good habits, but I'm knackered, truth be told. We do have a little bit of playtime here and there, but not too much, to be honest. How about you? What have you been up to?
Yeah, I've still been playing around with the Microgranny, the Nord Drum, you know, all my new stuff that I've had over Christmas. Been finishing the Eventide Space feedback loop pieces off. I want to get up to 4 on that. When I finish those, I'm going to wang those over for you to master for me, please. And then I've just been thinking about a new little project that I wanted to do, which was build a couple of like sound scenes of around a couple of minutes a piece with just using the continuum, construct that in the door, take that then through the speakers into the Microgranny speaker, like, you know, we was talking about using the air of the room on that, then doing a round trip onto cassette, and then just testing out gestural plane of those two.
I love the idea of catching air, as we spoke about that a lot before. But yeah. The idea of the sound of a room in a room in a room in a room, and Sam, Look Mum No Computer, did a great video on that that we'll link in the show notes. But I quite like the idea of sound in a room on a tape, in a room on a tape, in a room on a tape, trying to throw some other medium with a really nice kind of audio profile to it, real characterful sound. The original Room in a Room in a Room and Sam's video is playing a sound through some speakers in a room, recording it, and then playing that back through the same speakers in the room and so on and so on and so on until you're ultimately just left with this droning room tone. It's almost like an impulse response of the room that drones.
Alvin Lucier.
Yes, it was.
It's Alvin Lucier, right?
There we go. And that's the sound of our guest. Maybe you should introduce him, Ed.
I'm Alvin Lucier. Hello.
You can't keep this guest down, can you?
I'm in a room. You know, I think the deal was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Alvin Lucier had a speech impediment. And as a result, he kind of wanted to do almost a therapeutic bit of sound work.
Oh, okay.
Where his voice essentially disintegrated and all the sort of the bumps and the things that were irksome eventually turned into just resonance, you know. Mm. I believe that's the story behind it. So it began from a sort of, it's a healing method. Anyway. Alvin Lucier signing off. Hi guys.
See you later. I suppose on that note, I should start with who we have on our show today. Originally from Cambridgeshire, back here in Blighty, is a well-known award-winning British producer, singer-songwriter and performer. He has moved around a bit, and via his period in Berlin, he now resides in Nashville, Tennessee. You will hear his tracks everywhere, on television shows, commercials, video games, and more. Not content with being super successful in all these departments, he decided to start an interesting and informative podcast. We all know his creative nitties and his brilliant interviews. Many will know him for his amazing creative output using looping techniques, and it's nice to have been already schooled by him on podcasts. It's the one and only Jamie Liddell. Jamie, how are you?
I'm great, man. Yeah, I've been munching on these pecans, so if there's a little bit of a... I'm going to make your life hard. Loads of mouthy click.
Yeah, a bit of pecan editing to do.
I'm a naughty pod man. Like, oh, this is the worst thing to remove in both. Doing a plosive mid-pecan. You know,
you're just going to make it hard for us, aren't you?
No, I'm really not. It's great to be on, guys. I'm a massive fan of your show, and I haven't missed a single one.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. That's high praise, to be fair, coming from you, because we're massive fans of your show as well, Jamie. And I wanted to talk about a couple of things that have come up in sort of past shows.
Ooh, that's
nice. And the one was episode 49, Brink Beats. When you had him on, I was like, oh, yes, you know, Jamie talks to him. It's like the perfect storm. So thank you very, very much for doing that episode. And if anyone hasn't listened to that, they should definitely listen to that. I've got a few questions around that, because obviously he's into looping, and you did the show together, and we didn't hear how that show went because you just was interviewing him before that live show went on. So how did that go? What was the gig like? What happened? I'm really interested.
Yeah, I mean, he is, obviously, I don't need to tell you, he's a massive talent.
Oh, I love him.
His combination of the sort of brainiac, how are we going to make this work side, the aesthetic side of making a looping show super like inviting and like constantly like this kind of active world, which is a really critical thing, something that I worked really hard on as well. It's like, basically, show you're working is crucial to a live looping show, in my opinion. Yeah. So he's got that totally nailed. It's so, like, you know, dynamic the way he's doing it.
Yeah,
he's a real heavyweight, but obviously, as you can tell on the show and any other interviews, he's really a super down to earth guy and just really an open sort of creative mind. So yeah, the show was essentially his show. It was for the company Fab Filter. It's for a 15-year party of their company, basically, in Amsterdam. Right. And like, they had proposed to he and I that we do a collaboration for it. And so we did like one of my songs off my last record. And then we wrote a new song, which we haven't put out yet. But actually, you're reminding me, I've got to do the vocals again. So yeah, we did those two live, and then he continued to just crush it with his stuff later in the evening. So yeah, I got to see how it all works, and it's very clever stuff.
It is. So this leads me on to the question. He's, you know, showed how he loops, obviously very Ableton Max based. It looks extraordinarily complex, and how you perform that live is just amazing. It's obviously practice. So I'm definitely want to go down the route of looping, and I'm starting my journey down there, and I've got a Ditto looper at the moment, but I'm quickly coming to the end of what that can give me. What I'd like to know is, you know, where did your journey start equipment wise with looping, and what was the point where you go, okay, just hardware is not going to do this for me. It's got to be in software, or it's got to be a mixture of controllers to do what I want to do. Could you just let me know about sort of how that journey progressed technically?
Yeah, sure. I mean, ultimately, what happened was I moved to Berlin about 2000, and I was faced with a few financial realities. I signed with Warp Records in 1999, and I spent the advance they gave me for the record creation moving to Berlin. So I was just scuppered, and I thought, I've got to make money. So it was a sort of a necessity that I work out how to compete in a world of very competent electronic musicians. Like, I'd grown up and come up with people like Christian Vogel, you know, all the guys making techno around that time were super talented. I couldn't do it. So it wasn't my world of expertise. Just because I thought, I've never been that good at pattern-based sort of drum machine, like rocking a club, kind of this sequence into this sequence. Everyone was so good at that. I wasn't. So I had to take a kind of cold, hard look at myself and go, what do I do? What is my thing? And I was like, well, I like singing. I need to use my voice somehow. So I was like, how the hell am I going to use my voice and rock the club on my own? You know what I mean? Yeah. So it was basically this sort of just hard question. And I started to just mess around with very basic machines. I had a Boss, or one of those Roland like SP202s that you could record in, and like, you know, it would loop essentially once you got the pattern in. But then obviously, like a lot of people, it was the DL4, the old green delay.
Yeah.
The classic greenie that started me out. I got that when it came out. I'd actually been inspired to do the Looping show by Matthew Herbert, who some people will be aware of. is like a mentor of mine. We've done a lot of music together. I've sung on his records, played at the Hollywood Bowl, opening for Bjork in a big band that he put together. I mean, we've been through some shit, me and Matthew, and ages ago, there was a club night at the end. It was a night where loads of people just came through, and he did a show that night. A couple of things were cool about it. First of all, he played with essentially Boss pedals. They have a loop mode in some of those delays, like I think a very basic looper, essentially. Yeah. And like those pedal loopers was something that I heard the guitarist in my band at college kind of use. And I was like, man, he can just like rock this thing. Like the loops, just something about the loops. It just sort of came to me of the combination of Matthew Herbert and thinking about this guitarist and thinking, well, there you go. Once I had that pedal in my hands, I was like, I just needed to practice basically. And I would just go out and do shows in like Holland and, you know, in Belgium where they'll be like, yes, Jamie, come and just play some weird shit. There would, thankfully, there were those abstract venues where I could just go and make a mess. I kind of worked out my craft in front of people, essentially. Wow. It's a lot harder to do here in America. There's not that kind of community here.
Yeah.
But thanks to Europe, I got a chance to just make a lot of mistakes in front of people with that very crude setup. And sometimes I'd take a CD player out and I'd just have sort of playback moments so I wouldn't just be lost in the show. I could essentially do some wild freak out and then hit like a playback and do a little bit of a prepared piece. And sort of go between the two things. So I kind of knew that I had a bit more of a show on my hands. It was a bit more certain.
Yeah.
So I didn't just like completely lose the crowd, which happened a lot. But I just started to expand that. And then, I hit the wall with that. And then I realized that Max MSP could kind of open the door. So in about 2001, I'd actually used a piece of software called Lisa. Now, that's super old school. I don't know if you guys ever heard of that.
No, I haven't.
Lisa was back in the day. It was like another experimental kind of live sampling thing when I used to play with Super Collider in about 98.
Yeah.
99. I guess 99. We'd go out and use this thing called Lisa on a laptop, which would do real-time sampling and time stretching. And like I could sing a phrase, hold a key down, and then essentially sing a harmonized phrase with that old one back held down. You know, it's like super basic stuff, but it allowed me to interact with my own voice in a new way. So like I was kind of like versed in a couple of experimental techniques. But yeah, the Max thing was the big time when I essentially disappeared off the face of the earth, stopped making music. Everyone was really worried about me. Like, why are you doing this shit? You know, I remember people coming over going, this is lame. You can't, what are you doing? And I sort of just had it in my head and I got this fixed focus. And I started to build this looper and it was essentially a 5-track looper. I could loop on all the black keys with my left hand. The first one was the master loop, set them loop for all the others, the length. Yeah. Then the other 4 keys would essentially, you know, just record into the empty slots. The separate outputs came onto a console, which was really important. I had like a Mutron octave divider. Then I'd use the green delay just as a delay.
Yeah.
And then I'd have the MS-20 to do like pitch tracking and like, you know, I extended the whole thing so that I could essentially feed the console back into the looper and I could loop within the loop, which is something I got off the Boss 202.
Yeah.
SP-202 could do that. You could sort of, once the loop is playing, you could kind of loop inside the loop. So I added that to my looper, added like vary speed to the loops. I couldn't actually record at vary speed at that time. But just sort of had to jump in and get that going. I joke about it, but that looper like bought this house.
Wow.
I opened for James Brown with that looper.
Wow.
I opened for Bjork with that looper. I mean, I opened for Beck with it. I mean, like it was my career, really, that looper. And it was the only one of its kind. It was this Max looper that was my instrument.
Yeah,
I played it till I worked out. It was pretty limited. Now when I look at it, I'm like, how the hell did I do a show with this thing?
Wow.
It can do nothing. It's just so like powerless, but it was awesome.
Wow.
I mean, I could think with it. I got to that point where I just knew how to mute right on time. I could prepare where it was going to come back in. I could do like these one-shot stabs and do kind of scratching. Then you could do loop within loop and it would turn into like a beep you know, it would be such a tight loop, and then I could spin those into outer space and it would go, I mean, I could just do all these colors with it after a while. It's like playing any instrument.
Yeah.
Definitely something I'd recommend to anyone, and it's bloody hard to do in 2020 because there's so many options all the time, and people like Ben trying to make you buy stuff. I'm joking. Or at least putting on your radar other things. And like, and now God knows I'm in that place now, but having that stupidly limited system was just, obviously, creatives talk about this all the time, and it is a cliche for a reason. You need those limitations.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to have them, otherwise you can't express yourself, you know?
No, no. I've come up against that already, really, both in art and the journey with sound. So you built the Max, and then I've watched the video of you at Red Bull in 2014 with your setup.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a mixture of software and hardware. Where did you go from Max? Did you evolve Max into that system, or did you start swapping and changing from there?
I had a version 2 of the looper that I did with Brian Crabtree, Monome, great Max programmer. Yeah. We worked on a version 2 of my looper, which became pretty decent, actually, and it could do a lot more interesting stuff. But ironically, those improvements kind of killed it for me. I don't know. It just sort of became another thing, and I couldn't quite ever capture the ferocity of the basic looper. It just was hard for me to master the new power of it.
New paradigm.
It never became better, weirdly. Yeah. So the next jumping off point was getting Tim Exile's Flow Machine, which I felt very privileged because, again, that was guarded. But after a while, he gave me a copy. And what a masterpiece that is.
Is it really good?
It's
just staggering. It looks and sounds awesome.
It's the greatest looper, and I've tried them all,
really,
and it just shits on them all. It's just absolutely a masterpiece in so many ways. Short loops don't click, for example. It has intelligent knowledge of the quantizing of an idea you have, whether it's going to, you know, it just has loops of variable lengths effortlessly flowing with one another. It has like this ability to like mangle sound in a super potent way. It just, the sound of it is just brutal and quite controlled. I mean, he's got like auto level gaining. If you gain one thing up, others come down. It has like intelligent limiting. I mean, the whole thing is just staggering. Wow. It really is.
Yeah. And is that what you use now, or have you moved from there?
I don't really loop anymore. I've actually made one in the ER-301. It's quite nice.
Ooh.
I kind of made my own with some nice punch-in stuff, which is something that I value a lot. So, yeah, I made a good looper in the 301, and which turns into granular. So that's kind of a new thing.
So you don't keep this machine in the corner of your studio?
I used to.
Just because, like,
I did
you want to crank it out and do it.
You know, you're right. I mean, it's actually foolish of me to not have it, because every time I do go and have a rinse on it, I'm like, oh man, this is a world I love so much, you know. But it's a bit like, you know, remember there being a thing with Miles Davis where he kind of banned himself from doing ballads.
Right, yeah.
Because it's like much pleasure and a little bit. Oh, I'm trying to work out what else. But I think for a texture creator, there's still nothing better than looping. Chasing the spontaneity and the question and answer with yourself in a way.
I love that.
It was just like, oh, how do I respond to this? And especially with a voice or something that is so fast, you know, I can just get that whole thing happening in such a satisfying way.
I love this push-pull of looping. This is what I found out and I didn't realize was in it. It's like you put out a call and you respond to that call and you move these things around. And it's a lovely, I love that because it's very similar to how I'm painting, and I quite like that analogy, you know, that runs all the way through it. If someone's new to looping, where would you say to look to start from? Is it like rinse your hardware, then you're going to have to hit Ableton? Is that what you would say?
I mean, you know, it's a budget thing a lot of the time. I do believe, and I've been chatting with Beardy Man a little bit, which has been nice because obviously he's a marvelous looper. He's just taken that whole art to a whole other place. He really recommends the big boss looper. The 505, maybe?
Yeah, the 505. Yeah,
5 foot switches or something like that on it.
Yeah, he says it's amazing. So I haven't tried it. I would recommend that, actually.
Yeah.
I do like a standalone piece myself, just because I feel like it's inspiring to be away from the computer as much as possible.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's a budget constraint. So if you've got no budget, there's a looper in Ableton, and it's fine.
Yeah.
And you can learn a lot from it, and you can do really creative stuff. I did a Max for Live patch that kind of synchronized a bunch of them and remotely controlled them all. And it was super powerful, actually. I was like, oh, this is inspiring. You know, I had different inputs coming into different loopers and then coming out of different outputs and cross-modulating. And I was like, wow. I mean, you know, if you can think about it, you can do so much in Ableton. So they are all good.
Yeah. I mean, I like the 505 just for what it's got. I've had a look at the manual and you can do some complex stuff on there. It's brilliant. I just don't like the plasticky look of it. I mean, I know that's terrible to say, but I'm a real visual person, you know.
I know. Things
made out of steel and just, And I look at it and it's all like sort of blinky, sort of, you know, green neon. Although I did see at NAMM somebody come out with a very interesting looper.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, sort of touch screen on it. That looked very tricky, really good. So I'm going to keep my eye open on that.
But it's, I know the quality, the way a looper does decay, essentially, is one of the characters that draws you to it or not, I think.
Yeah.
So it's the way, I mean, obviously, the greatest loopers are reel to reels, of course.
Yeah.
Because the way that stuff decays in the background is just
beautiful, isn't it?
Unbelievably beautiful, yeah.
We've both been on a decaying tape loop tip for a long time.
Yeah.
Oh, Brian Eno's techniques and some of Terry Riley's techniques and Frippertronics and
of course.
The time lag accumulator effect, all this stuff that the sound of tape being involved in that. Because the Ditto, I think it's the Ditto X4 that Ed has, the decay knob, it's akin to a digital delay with a long delay time on 95% feedback. So it feels like a loop until it drops off. But even just going for anyone wanting to get into it, even the most basic guitar loopers, the one I still have somewhere is the original Ditto, which is about £65-70, maybe $100. I'm great fun with that thing. And some other pedals and me playing guitar into it, you put something in, you can't do any speed tricks, but I had an octave shifter. So it's like, right, let's drop the guitar down an octave on another pedal, play the bass line in, put some chords in, or just very basic stuff.
Yeah.
But it's tremendous fun. And it is quick and instant. And you're in like a flow state of ideas. The thing it couldn't do, being a very simple and cheap looper, was then pull those out on separate tracks, or it just became quite a dense mess quite quickly. You couldn't manage your loops in any way. But it's a cheap, simple looper. I didn't expect it to. But I loved it.
Coming back to your show, on episode 62, first of all, you have this amazing quality to bring out people's creative journeys, because I think that's quite a talent. I was listening to that particular interview, and you said that you've got the new album itch in you, and certain things push you into making modes. Because this happens to me, especially when I'm painting. I won't have the urge at all, and then suddenly I get this build up and this process of what I go through that puts me in this space where I can paint. And I'd just like to know what that build up is for you and what your creative process looks like.
It's interesting because I feel like I've hit this from lots of different angles, and I can kind of talk myself in and out of ideas very quickly.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just a modern condition, or maybe it's my age in life, what I feel like I need to say, how I want to say it. I mean, all of these, you know, every artist is confronted with these multiple things the whole time. Like even getting down to some existential things of like, why do I need to create? And you can really get in your own way in so many tantalizingly annoying ways. So, I mean, I think for me at this point, a couple of things have brought on the feeling. One of them was being invited really kindly by Dave Sitek to go out to the Sonic Ranch in Tornillo, Texas. And it's an amazing, reclusive environment. You know, you are literally on your own out there. There's no humans. Ironically, I'm eating my pecans now. It's a pecan farm. There's like, you know, thousands of trees around you. You're just there. You're left to your mind's activity, essentially, you know, almost like, you know, you hear the thoughts that you've repressed in a way because you've got no distraction. And it can be quite overwhelming, actually. It was quite overwhelming to me for a minute to be away from family, to be away from everything. But then I start to find this, well, I'm here now, and this is why I'm here, and it's time.
Yeah.
There's nothing in my way. I've really got to make the most of this time. So there was that, and I felt like this open road appeared. And even though it was relatively daunting to make a first move, I think for me, as soon as I start to get my vocals on something, I start to know what to do. And I don't think about the process, and then I really enjoy it. It's really like these awful moments of, well, not awful, but I think my current environment of trying to do music a lot of the time at nighttime when, you know, our son's gone to bed and I've got a bit of time to do stuff, I dilly-dally a lot and I try and clean up the studio and I get caught up in all kinds of other minutiae, and then the time goes by and I feel obliged to go to bed, and I just sort of feel like the only way I'm going to get anything done is if I just sit there with an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
And I swear, this is how it's going to happen, my new record. It's the only way. Dave Sutek told me this. He says, you cannot go into your studio. You're not allowed. You're not going to do anything in there. I mean, you might do after you've got some songs, but I'm going to give you this guitar. So he lent me a guitar, and like I sat there and played it again. I haven't played for ages. And he was right, because I sort of had nowhere to run to. And of course, you can pick up the guitar with no preparation. It doesn't need to be powered on. There's nothing to distract you. There's no lights. I mean, you know, back to that, it's the antithesis of the Roland box with all the flashing lights. It's like an inert wooden object just going, well, here I am. And so that was it for me. It's almost like getting back to basics was what I need currently. I need to get back to basics and kind of go, I'm going to write songs. And there's still some songs in me, and the guitar is proving that I still like these. And I like those voice memo notes, and that's all I've got. So that's it. I mean, that's maybe not answering the kind of core reason why there's that switch.
Yeah.
I think part of the switch for me is a kind of multifaceted thing. And obviously, it's a lot of it's kind of just I've done a lot of co-writing, and I've put my energy into a lot of other people's work, which I really like. But I love to sing, you know, I love to do this too, you know, and it's not about being the name on the tin. It's just about, I need the rush of it, you know?
Yeah.
I just want the rush. And so like, so that's it. It's more just kind of like loving it, you know, and remembering that.
So things are coming to a head with what you've done in the past, and you just get a feeling, right, okay, this is where we're going now. This is, I want to do something creative. And then you've chosen just to go down that very stripped down vocals and guitar to go down that path with.
I mean, yeah, but at the same time, like last night I was in the studio. I've bought a lot of crazy analog recording equipment and mastering equipment and like loads of Eurorack. I'm surrounded by the best studio I've ever had. Like I've really worked so hard on collecting like the best of the gear.
Yeah.
I'm in a kind of a sonic paradise here. So it's kind of like sometimes I just sort of have to, I look at it and I go, what is going on in here? It's like, it's amazing, but it can be crippling.
Yeah,
but I still love it. And I had a good rinse last night and I was like, oh man. It was sort of almost, sometimes I come in here, I just have a rinse and I'm like, think of people like Sun Ra and stuff. I'm just making a noise, man. And I'm just loving it. And I don't really care if anyone ever hears it. And I think you've also got to have that kind of just the joy of making noise. It's got to be in you.
The last bit for me in terms of enjoying the creation for myself and not for a job or a project or a deadline, I had to sit on the floor. And it wasn't acoustic guitar. It was boxes I had to plug in, but headphones on the floor and just having this kind of my peripheral vision being different. Not looking at the desk that I make demos on and not looking at the computer that I record into and all that kind of stuff. Just, I had to just move somewhere else. Had I had room, it would almost be nice to have a kind of creation room that is quite empty, and you take something in, like an acoustic guitar or a little synth and some pedals, whatever it might be. On that note of gear, I really want to dive into this modular journey. And for you, Jamie, from me watching from afar, it seemed somewhat recent, this big Eurorack takeover. But I did find an older video of yours where you had, I think, a little dope for beauty case with...
Yeah,
I did my homework for this show.
Yeah, man.
Maybe just an oscillator and a filter or something in a box or...
That's exactly it.
We'll link the video in the show notes. So when did you get that first bit of modular, and when did Eurorack really kind of bite and pull you in?
I was wondering if you were going to ask me that. When I had that thought this morning, I was like, when was it? Well, I believe I was using that on a tour in 2008, so I definitely had it by then. Basically what it was, I lived in Berlin, in Kreuzberg, for 8 years, and literally it took me about 5 minutes to walk to Schneider's.
Yeah.
Like, it was dangerous. Literally up the road. Yeah. But not really, because I didn't really care about that stuff at the time. I would go in and it was a curiosity, you know, in a way. But I did, you know, obviously his enthusiasm, anyone who knows him, is pretty undeniable. And my friends in Berlin called Stereo Total, and one of the guys, Bretzel, had this ribbon controller, like the dirt for ribbon, you know, based on the Troutonium controller. And I just used to see him on stage, and he had such a minimal setup. It was a very like punk show, but he had this ribbon mounted, and he would just kind of like do these kind of falling notes with a delay, like, and there was a really kind of clear visual of what he was doing, you know, not as sort of kind of kooky as a theremin and more controllable. And I was like, oh, that thing's awesome, man. I should just totally get on that. So I went to Schneider's, and he had a little beauty case already set up that was essentially that ribbon, yeah, into a Dirtfur oscillator. And then there's like an analog solutions filter, I think. And that's pretty much it. Yeah, I got a lot of mileage out of that. I used to run it through a TC Helicon, like Voice Live, the first Voice Live, and like quantize it. So essentially I put it through auto tune so I could be in the key of the song and just be like, and play scales. And so that was sort of how I tricked it. I actually did some stuff with a theremin, but anyway, yeah, I didn't have CV on a theremin at the time, but
I love the idea of the T-Pain effect over your modular.
I know, it was like that. It was total T-Pain modular, but it really worked, and it just allowed me to sort of be in with a band and not just be in some harrowing mid-space of microtonal doom, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And it's strange, it can be quite expressive. I'm sure as much as we've all heard horrible auto-tune music, there's a lot of great auto-tune music out there as well.
But when you're in the right note, you know, the Dirtfur thing kind of has pressure. So I set the pressure to like control like the pulse width and some filter stuff. So it kind of talks quite a lot within the note. So really, I just wanted to be on note so that I could do the expressive stuff. Do you know what I mean? And I could turn off the voice live when I wanted to glitz.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was like, is this a pitch quantizer? You know, you'd have one in a Eurorack, right?
Maybe not pitch for audio. I've got CV quantizers to get the information in before it controls something, but I don't know if I've actually got anything that doesn't
there you go. Right
now.
Something else to buy.
I know I used to think that when I got into mods, I was like, how do I just get this into like A minor or something? And yeah, I was used to that. I was like, I can just, and I by that point I'd done production work where I could just throw a quantizer on. Just, right. And you know, you do all the kind of studio tricks of, well, if we have a slightly slower response time, it's going to be quite natural, but it's just going to pull her in key a bit or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I was kind of looking for that. How can I just gently nudge my random noodlings in? And then you plug audio into a CV quantizer, and what you're effectively doing is bit crushing. And I didn't know that. So I'm just like, what the fuck is this? I don't get what this is.
Does it sound any good?
Yeah, if you think about it, because it's working in the kind of non-time domain, the vertical bit domain of audio, if you like, and you turn notes on and off, you're turning off bits.
Oh, right. That's cool.
Per octave, you've then got your 12 semitones. And you could turn off, say, F on the quantizer and just pull one of those, one bit of information for every octave out. It's almost like a more expanded version of, is it the biscuit? The auto biscuit?
Yeah, that's right. I've got that biscuit.
We can like bit flip and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's an interesting technique.
Definitely.
So fast forwarding from that,
Yeah.
Obviously, your rack's exploded now. I saw a picture the other day. Is it three or four cases of things and lots of audio goodies? When did that really kind of bite? When did you sort of think, oh, man, were you looking for a while thinking, no, I'm not doing this. I'm not good. You knew you'd be down the rabbit hole.
No, yes, of course I did. And now, yeah, that's the thing. I've got Polysynths, you know, I've got a, you know, OBX and a Prophet 5 and a Jupiter 4. And, you know, I've got some nice mono synths as well. So I kind of felt like, come on, I've got enough synths. If I want synthy texture, I've got it. But I was like, ah, yeah, but it's not that. This cerebral side of me is something that's come from, you know, my school years, really. It's sort of like the tag they used to put on me back in the looping days was like soul scientist, which I was like, that's cool. I'll take soul scientist. So, I mean, the science part of me has always needed a bit of a reason. And I like to do things like, you know, I'll set myself like quite strict tasks to try to recreate an idea. And I did that in the Max days, set myself almost exercises to achieve the bigger goal, knowing I needed to make the component parts. And I do that with Eurorack and try to enjoy the process of adding the pieces together. So yes, that's why I ended up going from one. I just got the IntelliGel case and, you know, the 7U one. So then I got another one. Then I got a Make Noise one. And then I got three Make Noise skiffs. And I still got like a couple of pods full of stuff. And I got the Acme clock. Yeah, it just went on and on.
So is each case one of these creations? Was it this wider concept, this kind of artistic thing of I need to be able to do X or Y or Z? And each case is kind of a somewhat limited space in what it offers you, or limited set of functions. Like you've got a looping type machine or a sample manipulator machine. Is there an effects box or a out there drum machine? I mean, my setup's constantly changing and it drives me mad, but that's the work I'm doing. I'm demoing this stuff. I've tried to have a demo case very unsuccessfully. often manufacturers, if you're demoing a filter, will want you to use their oscillator, and that's completely fair when you're working with them to show more than one of their devices at once. So I end up not just needing, I need a 12 HP space. I'm pulling a row out at once, and it just is chaos. And it really, I've gone the other way. If I have a smaller case that isn't the video demo rig, the smaller cases are the instruments. There's my 6U drum machine that is everything I could have wanted in chasing analog drum machines, which is something I never really got into. I'd gone to Simpson, didn't really care for drum machines, but building my own has been very interesting. Sequencing exactly how I want, the range of sound sources how I want. But is that how your cases are working as well? Do you have these purpose-built cases, and how long do they stay as they are? Do you tend to move stuff around a lot?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of did start. I mean, the first case was I wanted to get the Surge stuff. So I got like the random source. I got three NTOs and
it's lovely.
Yeah, and because I thought I want to do poly, a kind of a poly synth modular and see what that's like. I blew up the sign. I plugged, you know, my B&K filter into the, it's funny that B&Ks have come, but I had that thing in Berlin about 2004, used it on a couple of things. I used it on a few albums, but it's funny to see the B&K stuff really coming up.
I bet you've got that for barely anything.
It's beautiful. I threw the output of that thing into one of the NTOs and totally fried it. So that was fun. So the Surge case was my first one. And I had a couple of chats with the guy, a modular addict, Jim, who's been helpful like to kind of steer me. You know, I'll be honest, if I could do it all over again, I would just go Buchla.
You see, it's interesting.
I just would do it. I knew I wanted Buchla years ago.
Yeah.
2008, what I was going to do is spend my entire Warp Advance on a Buchla, you know, and just go, this will be my record. This is it.
Right.
I'm quite glad I didn't do that, because now knowing how brutally complex those things are, I wouldn't have made music for a long time.
No.
And it would have screwed me. But now, even at NAMM, I went and checked that little new, was it 208C?
The top part of the easel.
What the hell, man? The sound of the oscillators is just incredible.
They're awesome,
man. I was like, this is insane. I mean, it's really just knowing the sound you're going for, isn't it? And I think at this point, I know what that is. So that's all right. I can kind of get there with the system I have. My three cases, essentially, I've got the drum case, a Folktech Matter, and a sample drum, and a... I got like one of those Syncussion, but Japanese Concussion, which is great. Squid Sample, Rampage, You're Cleaning Circles, Crush Delay.
Man, I love that Crush Delay. I love
that. Yeah, Crush Delay is awesome. Christian Vogel did a set where he had five. It's only using those. He didn't use nothing else.
I love just the noise of PT delays. I know that Cenk from Electron, when he goes out and performs live as Dataline, he's got a little skiff of Modular now, and it's pretty much for the Crush Delay.
That's amazing.
Facing in and out, back, I think out of the Octatrack and back again with all the other Electrons kind of plumbed into an Octatrack. There's something about it, the way that kind of noise of the PT responds to the input at those longer delay times, it's magic.
I've got the Magneto and the Mimeophone. Kind of got the delays covered. Plus, I've got loads of delays in the rack.
Yeah.
Now I've moved all my Eurorack over to the main studio, and now it's all plumbed in really nicely. I've got like ins and outs in lots of ways, direct DIs, and then also the NW2S, especially for sending audio into the unit. I've been noticing that's pretty handy. So yeah, I mean, I'm pretty happy. I can get MIDI from the computer really well. I had a brilliant jam the other night with a friend of mine here in town. It's called Aaron Harmon. He used to be in the band Basecamp. Some Nashville electronic musicians. They're few and far between. We kind of like had a bit of a rinse the other night using this thing called Cordamist, I think it's called. Some Korean programmer made it in Max for Live, and it is incredible. And knowing Max for Live a little bit, it's some of the best work I've ever seen.
Wow.
And it's phenomenal. And like linked to the Hermod, and we're using the assimilators like in phase mod, sample mode against all the surge stuff going. And then like, just these tone colors we were getting was just, it's just bonkers. We were just laughing. It was so powerful.
I mean, we could talk gear and...
Oh, I know.
All day. But having a few cases now, kind of being properly in the Euro thing, figuring out that there's bits of it sonically you maybe don't like, whether that's gain stage or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Bits that you do, the system's working, as you say, everything's integrated now.
Yeah.
How's it fitting the kind of creative process? Does looking at that as a system compared to other gear change your approach at all, or does it not fit that moment of creation, that want or need to create?
I need to come to the system with a plan. That's how I work. And what's funny, I'll notice happening is a friend will come over and just go, hey, what's the deal with all this stuff? And then I'll sort of get into teacher mode. And then I'll sort of get enthused about the bits and go, oh, you can plug this in over here. And then all of a sudden I'm buzzing because they're kind of working out what's going on. And so I see what can be done almost. Whereas I've got so many sequential switches. I've got like, you know, the Muck Slicer, and I've got three other sequential switches because I just love the mindset of using sequential switches for sequences and audio path stuff. Obviously, minus the clicks, but I can de-click all that stuff. I don't care about that. But I like thinking of the modular as this way to sort of bring feedback under my hands, essentially. I'm a feedback man. And for me, the Eurorack embodies feedback, embodies chaos in a beautiful way, where I like to set up a system that is teetering on the brink and try and ride that chaos, because I know how to get order in so many other ways. I don't need the case to be doing a bass line.
No.
You know, I don't need the case to be doing rudimentary shit, because I can do that in live quicker and better. So I want the case to be alive. I want it to be free. I want it to feel electric, and I want it to feel like it's on the edge, and it's giving me tone colors. I start with a pure motive, and then it relatively quickly disintegrates, and it's all fun. But the problem is, I think the biggest challenge for Eurorack users is knowing how to make sense of the spewed audio that you've made. It's great fun to make it, but it really is this question of what do you do with that stuff? How do you edit it? Do you edit it? You know what I mean? That's my biggest challenge with it. It's like, if you want to ask in the creative situation, I can make all day. I remember reading a thing with Eno where he's like, my job at this point is not making sound. If I'm going to make sound, I'll just make a couple of sounds. And like have that serious discipline. I'm going to make a really, really decent sound. Just one.
I think we all find ourselves exploring. And even though when you do hit record, you just have hours of stuff that makes sense of it. It's great for sample. Yeah. I don't want to get into a debate of what is and isn't music, but for me to say this is music, this is a track, this is a piece.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't always think what I'm doing is necessarily music, at least in intent. an output for me.
Yeah.
Maybe someone else feels differently, that's fine. But so much of it is just sample fodder. And then I'll say to the AW and be like, man, these beats are kicking. Because I've gone through that kind of just a rainy Sunday afternoon of making odd, quirky one-shots. That tends to be how I make use of it, more than music. Have you found your voice in an artistic sense in the system? And do you ever get your actual voice as an instrument into the system?
Last night was the first time, actually, funny you ask that. I've been wanting to do it for ages. I mean, I set up for the last Nitty, like the squid sample delay from their like little Instagram posts and stuff. It's a pretty convoluted thing, but satisfying. And I want to do the same thing with the assimilator because I'm sure it can do it. Plus a new firmware on the assimilator, sound on sound is so good. So I'll probably try and get my voice into that. But yeah, I've been messing a lot with the ER-301 and I've made a pretty nice combination of things in one skiff that I'm really satisfied with. I've got the Q-bit buttons, the arcade buttons, right next door to the like the crossfader, the emblematic Catalyst crossfader.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those things are right next to each other. So there's the button and the fader. And I set up a thing in the 301 where if I'm holding one of the buttons, it's conditional. It will change the meaning of the fader. So like if I hold the button down, it will record into the buffer. Then I hold the second button down, it will spread the pitch of the grains of three granular samplers.
Dreams, yeah.
And so they will essentially pull apart to destinations that are set on the fader. So I can sing a straight note in monophonically and then freeze it and essentially spread it to chordal destinations. But then the third button scans through the initial sample. All the grains are essentially at the same point at the moment. I'm using the Oct, Ben. I've got the Oct fully rocking on that patch.
Nice.
Changing pans and levels on the whole thing. And I mean, I was there for hours last night and it is really deep. That again, it's a bit like my looper. It's not that powerful. I was pretty satisfied that in the 301, I could do these conditional things with the gates. So when the buttons are held down, it tells the 301 to sort of essentially shut down listening to the fader and like assigns it another role. That's really going to be my voice with the modular. I think about performing live, it's got to be with the voice.
Yeah,
I won't do it any other way. So yeah, I've been having a hard time. I've been putting it off because I've not been very fluent with the system. But now I'm much more accomplished and I can get around it. I'm not intimidated by it. I know what everything does, essentially. Not everything, but you know, you can't, can you? It's frustrating with the 301 and stuff. It's such a steep learning curve. I come back to it. It takes me a good hour to get back into that mindset. But so does Max. Yeah, I think that's going to be my way. I'll be kind of curious, a combination of the squid, the assimilator, and I wish the assimilator would sort of, I know it can explode like rhythm stuff now and put it onto different groups, but I kind of wish it would kind of automatically explode. I like a system where I could just record some kind of beats with my voice or some other system and it would just spread it out for me like automatically.
Yeah.
And rather than me have to menu dive and do that. So
Bitbox from 1010, I think.
Does it?
Some auto slice type stuff to the audio, yeah.
As soon as you record. So you just hit record, it does it, you let go, it's spread out.
I don't have it, so I can't confirm.
Yeah. I know I saw Richard recently, the NAM, he had like two of them in a box. You know, one of my early Max patches I was trying to do is like have basically a pattern set up. Like, so I know the rhythm is already determined and then switch out sounds. So like I made instant samplers in Max where there's like a beat happening and then I can switch out the sounds underneath, but the pattern is the same. Mm. And that's like super nice to be able to like instantly replace stuff. But, you know, you keep a kind of solidity. That would be really cool. Working out a way to do that would be nice. 301 could do it if I put my brain to it. Again, it's amount of man hours. I've got like 3 hours in the evening to try and do something. At the Sonic Ranch, I made a lot of stuff in the 301 because there was no distractions. And I thought, I'm going to learn this box now. I think anyone with Eurorack, you've got to be careful. You've got to take a box, learn the box, and then move on. I mean, I did the worst thing. I remember Boys Noise wrote to me and said, you've lost the plot. You've got way too much too quick. And I was like, yep. You're 100% right. I've completely screwed it. But now I'm all right.
Yeah. I still like things in the smaller box or the skiff. Just this idea of, well, that's the instrument. And being so strict to myself that you think, oh, I wish I'd just put X in, or if I could just have two of these, I could do this. It's like, well,
yeah,
I might be in this same room where I could literally reach over and do it in 5 minutes, but choosing not to and going, well, not till the weekend. These next few evenings, that is what it is.
So right, man. So right. I hear that last night with the thing. I was like, now it's time to bring in the assimilator and record the output and like have that sound on sound record and push back into the system. And I was like, oh yeah, really? You're going to set that up so it really works. You're going to lose all the flow you're having now.
Yeah.
Like you're in a moment where it's, you're vibing and you're making stuff. And I was hitting record and I was loving what's coming out. I was like, yeah, I could stop all that and maybe try to build that. You're going to hit loads of roadblocks along the way. And like, you know, it may be cool, but yeah, I think you've got to know when you're rocking and just kind of, a man is a discipline. You've got to have discipline in your process. You have to have discipline. You have to learn discipline, like when to turn the system off, when to start editing. Like I tell you, man, that reel-to-reel thing that started to come into my flow, I've got to pull that back in. The tape ending was a brilliant thing. I was like, okay, tape's ended. I've got to rewind the tape and play that back in the computer if I want to keep that stuff. So then I became the listener. Then I was like listening to the music I'd made and I had to sit through the performance. Mm. And it wasn't that long because the tapes aren't that long. But then it gives you this chance of going, I'm respecting what I just did. And like, I'm now going to sort of mark the bits and then go, keep this, don't keep that, keep this, keep that. And then go through, throw the stuff away and do that now. Don't come back to a session with 2 hours of audio. That is not being good to your future self.
No.
You know what I mean? You've got to look at it, stop, have to have the discipline. Something has to sort of happen. Maybe there should be a power timer on the modular where it just turns off. It's like, game over.
Yeah. I remember we weren't recording to tape, but working with Bruce Wood, who is the engineer for Nightmares on Wax, among a lot of other people in Leeds up here in England.
George.
Yes, George from Nightmares.
I know George. We were touring like in the early 2000s, man. I love George. He's brilliant, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's Bruce Wood has the studio up on the edge of Hyde Park in Leeds, and we were recording there. And every time we'd get through some takes or a number of takes, he was great at telling us to stop. Like, but man, we just like, let's go again, like hit record again. But he would go, let's just go make a cup of tea. And his kitchen, he had a kitchen in the basement as well. So you'd walk through one door to the kitchen from where we were, but he would straight away start playing just for a little set of GBLs up on the wall in the kitchen what we'd just recorded.
Oh, nice.
So you weren't listening through the big studio monitors, but you were forced to kind of put the guitar down, go put the kettle on, chat, and not that loud. It wasn't like we were silent and it was forced listening, but he'd just be pumping it through into the kitchen. And it really made a huge difference to just walk away, but not, it somehow kept you in that state. Your brain's firing of all the things you should have done or could do or things that need an edit.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of feeding you it. As you're grabbing a tea bag, it just
totally, man.
Here's the thing. And if from then on, any other studio I've been, I'm like, man, why don't they have a little speaker in the kitchen? Why are they we've just been doing? Because it works. And you could see it then working with everyone
completely,
else.
Completely, man. Completely. And I mean, that's the thing I noticed, and it really frustrates me. Just sitting in front of the computer, I'm not a good listener in front of the computer. I know, I don't know if you have that as well. I just sort of, looking at the screen changes the way you listen. So I would love to invent some, I'll probably do it soon. Like I'll probably just do it with this wireless keyboard actually. I'm just going to set up this wireless keyboard, sit on the couch and then have it just basically send MIDI notes as I'm listening to audio and then make a note underneath the audio. Yeah. And then I can look, it's like adding markers, but it'll just be notes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That'd be so handy because then I can just walk around the room with a wireless control and go, oh, that bit, that's good.
Yeah. It's like the difference between a studio where the computer monitors between the speakers or it's off to the side. And I've, through force of the small space I'm working in, my computer is off to the side. But it's been a blessing in that even if wheel the chair over into, you know, the proper listening position between the speakers, then I'm not staring at the screen. And almost fortunately, my eyesight's not good enough to look into the corner of the room and really look at what's going on. So I'm forced to kind of slide out into a different kind of perspective and standing up, even just standing up. And then I'm at the wrong position. Speakers are at ear level and it's wrong, but it's somehow that's where the most critical thinking and kind of decision.
Same goes. So yeah, no, exactly. And the same goes for writing songs. You know, I really enjoyed working with this one artist and they insist on kind of going for a walk, kind of in the middle of the process and go, I'm just going to go for a walk now. That's like, all right. Usually you kind of grind it out in the room, like, and it's sort of quite a forced process at times when you're really kind of like problem solving writing. It's like, yeah, you know, when you said that, why don't we try and say it like this? In a way, that kind of contrived thing always leads to a relatively contrived product, I think. Whereas there's these moments of expression which kind of you hit on. I mean, this is the dream, and it doesn't happen very often. But, you know, when you're splurging and it's coming from a different place, I think sometimes it's so important to realize that you're in a certain mode and it's quite dull. There's a dull mode of creativity, and there's an active mode of creativity. Obviously, you can't be in the magic space the whole time. But if you kind of can be disciplined again to honestly ask yourself, am I just going through the motions here? Am I really listening? Do I care? You know, the sort of some fundamental questions. You know, if you can reset somehow, cup of tea, whatever, it's really important. And I mean, stepping away, hard to do, man. You get lost in it. You feel like you just go grind it out and grind it out. No one eats. And it's just this thing. And it's just not good.
Yeah. The great.
I swear.
More of a technical ear reset than kind of creative reset, although it did serve us both, was to go outside. Again, this was at Touchwood, Bruce Wood's studio.
Yeah.
He would tell you to go outside and listen for the most distant sound. It wasn't just, oh, you know, go grab a drink, stand outside, listen for a distant sound. It was, oh yeah, I think I could hear the M1 the other day. And you're like, not from here, you can't. And maybe you didn't. Maybe it's games. And he knew that that would somehow just change your mind as you went outside. But that going outside and listening for the most distant sound I can try to make sense of has always been a really lovely ear reset.
Wow, yeah.
On a technical level, it always works. Just the ear fatigue. You make things way too bright and then you come back in.
That's
like,
right.
This is brittle and horrible because I spent too much time, too loud, too bright. It always technically works as a reset. And a lot of the time creatively as well.
That's great. Great advice. I tell you what, though, that was the thing about the Tornillo, Texas out in the Sonic Ranch. You didn't hear the road. Mm. And it's like, how many places can you go now when you don't hear the road? I mean, it's getting harder, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like, that was amazing. Yeah. You could see the stars. I mean, all these sort of really basic things. It gave you power. I don't know. It just gave you the knowledge in yourself. There was something deep that made me feel like relaxed or something.
Yeah, I think.
Vulnerable. Lots of different emotions, but anyway.
Yeah, I think, you know, that sounds a very meditative place to go. And I have to say, discovering meditation for me over the last probably 3 years has been a game changer in resetting my creative process. It's quite a physical thing that's, you know, easy to dial in and to do and get fantastic results. And I found just the reset of that, just like a 20-minute meditation, boom, really freshens me up, really sort of gets me out of one headspace into another. And I think places that have got that meditative feel, like places that are very quiet or in the middle of nowhere, have that type of effect on you without you knowing, really.
That's interesting. Do you have a meditation, like, fixed time in the day, or do you just...
Well, I'm a bit scrappy with it. I mean, I'm one of these people that listens to Tim Ferriss and all the people that try and, you know, get the best out of their lives and put all these things in place to be the best person you can. I mean, I try and do all these things. So, like, I've got a morning routine. The definite morning routine is get up. First thing I do is just do a little meditation, you know, as I'm waking up, because they reckon that's like a really nice sort of transient time.
Definitely.
So I'll do it. I'll sort of go downstairs, express what I want from the day, if you like, then sort of go up, have a cold shower. That's like the thing that I've been doing for a while now, which I find really good. I don't know if you heard a guy called Wim Hof breathing techniques, which is I'll tell you what, mate, it's really amazing. I mean, so like what I've done throughout all my life is I'll try anything that I can get an edge over. I'll try it. If it don't work, I throw it out. If it does work, I'll keep it. Like, I've tried all eating, different types of eating, everything. I'll just give it a go, you know, like that, just experiment with it. And Wim Hof was one I was a skeptical on. I thought that might get thrown out, but once I did it, it's like, freaking hell, this is a game changer. So basically what it is a mixture between cold therapy, and heavy breathing, basically. So you're hyperventilating. He does it in a certain way. Okay.
Yeah.
So what it basically does, a couple of different things. It creates shock hormones within your body, the cold showers and that. So he's done a lot of scientific studies on it now, and it's coming out that, you know, there's a lot of positive benefits. So you get these shock hormones that start coming into your body, and then you get this hyperventilation, and what you're doing after the hyperventilation is holding your breath. So actually all the carbon dioxide starts building up in your blood as well. And what this does is physically it's shown to alkalize your blood. And when you've got your blood's alkalized, then you're in more of a relaxed state. You're in more of a immune boosted state. At first I found meditation quite hard. There's an app called Headspace if anyone's going to try it. And he runs it through it very well and explains meditation is not all about just clearing your mind out of every thought. That doesn't happen. It's about quietening your mind, acknowledging the thoughts and letting them pass, and then get back to your breathing. And then you'll start thinking about something again, and you acknowledge you're thinking about it, and you let that go, and you get back to your breathing. That's basically how you start meditating. And it's very hard at first. First week is, you know, quite hard, and then it gets easier. But I notice with the Wim Hof, if I do this Wim Hof breathing, so after I do the cold shower, the Wim Hof breathing, I automatically go into this very calm meditative state where I can just do an easy 15-20 minute meditation then. And it feels, when I come out the other side, it feels like everything is right with the day before I start the day. And honestly, absolute game changer. If I can say to anybody to start a little mini morning routine, which is just getting up, doing some deep breathing, doing a little bit of meditation, it really starts your day on the right sort of path. And it's like in me now. So like if I'm having a bad time, you know, things are not going well, and you get that sort of like anxious, tight feeling in your chest and your stomach. It's like, I just, okay, no, let me just take myself away from here, do some breathing, do a bit of a meditation, and I'm absolutely back in the game. It's been a massive game changer for A, for my life, and B, creativity-wise. But I say that, and, you know, it doesn't happen every day. I mean, some days I'll do a quick one day. Some days I'll forget. But I know when I do. I know when I forget because, like, throughout the day, I'm going like, hang on a sec, this ain't going. And, okay, I didn't do the medi this morning. So it's, it sounds like that ranch experience is similar.
But
what I love about a little morning routine or the meditation stuff is you can have a little chunk of that wherever you are. You don't need to be at the ranch. Don't get me wrong, it's very different. If you're doing that in the ranch as well, that's even better, of course.
That's right.
But you can have a little chunk of that, take a little chunk of that for half hour and then come out of that little sort of trance, very nice and relaxed. So yeah, I do think that it's a key to unlocking a lot of things and has really helped me.
It sounds like that, you know, a lot of people will go for a walk. I'm just 20 minutes, 30 minutes, I'm just going to go walk around the block or whatever.
That's right.
Yeah. If you've got a different way of doing that and just hitting reset, then that's amazing.
Yeah.
It is.
It just helps.
I mean, you know, it's almost like, worth getting up a little bit earlier than you need to.
Yeah.
Just to give yourself some respect in that way. I remember reading a thing that Machine Drum posted, and I was stuck with it. Very similar thing in a way. It's like kind of having a bit of respect for yourself in the morning rather than going, oh God, jump out of bed like super fast, grab your phone, going, oh no. You're instantly into sort of cortisol mode. You're like stressed straight away. So it's just like you can easily get into that in your life. I mean, I did that this morning, I'll be honest. I was up a bit late. I thought, well, oh no. You know, and then there's that sort of sinking feeling of like it does stay with you a little bit all day, doesn't it? Sort of takes your energy a little bit. But great advice.
Great
to hear.
I love the quietness of the house before the kids get up. It's just like,
you have to get up super early then. What time are you up?
Yeah, about 5:30 normally. That
seriously. Yeah, oh boy. Yeah, so that just screws with me because my creative time is nighttime.
Yeah.
That's what's messing my head up a bit.
But I say,
'cause I like the morning so much. I love that time, you know. I would like to have that, but then
I want the night as well. That's the
And I'm getting like a few hours. I'm getting like about 6 hours sleep, and it's not quite enough, to be honest.
No,
it's all right, but I'm just on a bit of a chase. I don't know about you, Ben, but
similar. I'm not getting 3 and 4 hours. I'm getting more than that, but I'm just not quite.
I know. Never get there.
In the mornings, exactly as you're saying, it's kids up. and it's you're kind of wired for that for the day then.
Yeah,
kind of it. Yeah, burning through that at the minute. Yeah. I like the night. I do like the night.
So do I. That's the thing.
My partner doesn't. My kid doesn't.
That's
the
right.
Kind of schedules
right.
that they're on. I'd like.
Same here.
And not all night. I've never been one to go till 3 and 4, particularly, or certainly not in the last maybe 10 years or so, but certainly into, you know, late night, midnight is kind of where I like to work towards. But nowhere going to get anywhere near enough sleep.
That's it. Guaranteed. Yeah.
Yeah, I say R5 every morning, but I do cycles. Like, you know, if I want to do a creative thing and it's going to be late at night, then obviously I'm not going to be up at R5. I mean, I try and aim to get that, to get the quiet time, but obviously life intervenes, doesn't it, like everything. So
but I was wondering though, for the night owl, maybe you could sort of set up a little night meditation.
Yeah, well, but
I'm saying
yeah, a lot of people say that as well, is the preparation for night. I read kind of a book, can't remember what it's called, but it's all about preparing yourself at night for the day in advance.
You know? That's maybe one for you and me, Ben.
Yeah.
We sort of get it in at night and just be like, all right.
Yeah,
I did do that the other day. It was sort of inadvertently, I got really stoned with my pal and I haven't been that smoking that much, but it kind of really hit me. I took way too much. And then at night, I was like spinning a little bit, like, oh, shit, this is way too intense. But somehow, my only way to fight it was to really relax.
Yeah.
So, like, I thought, oh, this is nice. And rather than just falling asleep, I took the time to sort of chill everything out.
Yeah.
And let it all go. And I woke up in the morning with a lot less sleep than I should have had, but I was more refreshed.
Yeah.
Because I took this mental time to, rather than just kind of turn off the lights in my mind, I kind of like gave myself permission to let go of the stuff that was worrying me. That was a night routine, kind of a forced one.
Oh, yeah.
But it did really work. It did really work. It's almost like you could do it before going to bed. It's like just before, rather than just kind of hitting the pillow and going, all right, night, night. Out, take a little moment to then do a little bit of letting go of some stress.
Yeah.
Kind of putting the bags down, essentially.
Yeah.
Kind of going, I don't need this baggage right now. I do not need it. I'm going to go to sleep. It's on my mind. But like, rather than just kind of going, yeah, sure. Well, that's what's going to happen when you fall asleep anyway. It's a different part of your consciousness, isn't it? If you consciously give yourself permission to let it go versus like turning the lights out on your consciousness. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer in that too. I mean, I definitely like the idea of somehow like kind of freeing the mind, because you're not going to get much interesting stuff if you're just working just from stress. But, you know, sometimes you have to.
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
But, yeah, gentlemen. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, can I just say that has been fantastic. Thank you. You're a very easy guest.
Oh, that's good. I can ramble on all day, can't I?
Yeah, I could chat to you all day, to be fair. But I think that probably wraps the show up very nicely there. And Jamie, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Love your podcast. Love what you do. So thank you very much for your wise wisdom and knowledge today, sir.
You're too kind.
So as we end the show, we'd like to shout out some of our Seattle connections. Tim Held's Podular Modcast. There's a new episode of A Source of Uncertainty, the Buchla podcast from Kyle and Robert. The shop Patchworks, who very lovingly funded and helped me come out to DivKids West Coast Adventure. Ellison's Waveform magazine. And Modular Seattle, who are putting on regular events for both Modular on the Spot and Modular Nights events every month.
We release our shows every month now, so remember to subscribe on your favourite podcasting platform. If you want to see a detailed show notes, then please head over to our website, which is www.esotericmodulation.com. And we also have a monthly newsletter over there you can sign up for.
And that's it. Thanks again, Jamie. Thanks, Ed. And I shall see you, Ed, next time.
Yeah. See you all. Thanks, Jamie.
See ya. Thanks, guys.
Cheers, man.
Bye.
Bye.